listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm pleased to have the brain trust behind Crescat Capital with me today for a second time. I've learned about Crescat Capital as a result of Quentin Henning joining the firm last year, where he assists the company in selecting gold and silver exploration investments. Of course, I have the highest regard for Dr. Henning. He has much more than any other exploration geologist I have met over the past 40 years in this business, the ability to discover major gold and silver deposits that have been passed over by generations of geologists before him. Crescat is very fortunate to have Quentin on his team. That said, having become a weekly viewer of the Crescat Gets Active YouTube series, I have really come to appreciate the financial genius of both of my guests today, Tavi Costa and Kevin Smith. Their expertise really explains why Crescat has had such a remarkable track record over a number of years. And if you want a very good review of where the financial markets are each and every week, and also to keep track of some of the emerging world-class gold and silver discoveries discussed on this show, I would suggest companies like SK Mining, Eloro Resources, and Lion One Metals. They're sponsors of this show. They're also companies that I've invested in and are in my newsletter. Was to just name three, there's a host of others that I think have great upside potential. But to learn about these markets, why they're doing what they're doing, I think you should really tune in every week to Crescat Gets Active. It's about 2 o'clock, I think, New York time when the show, you can watch it live as I do many times, but if you can't, it's available to you afterwards. But both Kevin and Tavi are just doing a remarkable job managing the company's funds, and we'll get to their performance in just a few minutes from now. But I'm really happy to have them with me once again. Thanks, both of you, for joining me.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Jay.
So I'd like to start out by asking both of you, what is your current assessment of today's global economy and financial markets? And I'm guessing you both are pretty much on the same page on this, but maybe we start out with Tavi, and then Kevin, you can pick up where Tavi leaves off.
Yeah, no problem. Look, I think we are we don't know yet if this is going to be a major downturn or a deceleration of growth, but certainly there's a list of recession indicators is starting to pile up here. One of them that I think is very important is what's happening with the yield curve. I mean, we're seeing yield curve inversions all over the treasury curve. About 30% of the yield curve is inverted today. So we calculate a more comprehensive way of seeing the all possible combinations of spreads in the treasury curve. And we calculate that close to 30% of that is inverted. When we get to 70 to 75%, it's almost immediately follows a recession. So we're getting there, not there just yet. The initial jobless claims, lowest levels in 60 years. So, you know, we're seeing job markets being very tight, meaning it's very strong, which is also a contrarian indicator. But the one thing that is quite concerning, I think, for us has been what's happening with ISM manufacturing starting to roll over and leads operating margins by about 6 months. So we have energy costs rising, wages and salaries and material costs after this kind of once in a lifetime boost in fundamentals financed by the government. So we're worried that we're going to see squeeze in margins, and that may create problems as the Federal Reserve is tightening. So that's basically our assessment of the U.S. economy for now. Kevin, if you want to add something.
Yeah.
Sure. I just add that, you know, on top of this, there's a lot of opportunities on the short side of the equity markets because of this. As part of our overriding great rotation theme, we want to be short overvalued companies that are going to either come under pressure from rising costs of capital and rising inflation pressures, or this general rotation out of the large cap and out of the technology sector and into the more undervalued commodity segments of the market, where there's a lot more intermediate term growth opportunities and much lower valuations.
Yeah, getting to this yield curve issue. Tavi, you've come up with one, the U.S. percentage of yield curve inversions. I guess that's what you were talking about. You said 75% is kind of a key level that indicates that we're heading towards a recession. I guess what this means is that would be 75% of the yield curve is inverted. Is that what that 75% is?
Yes. So that is correct. The 70% is the calculation of all possible spreads. There's about 45 spreads in the yield curve, and you calculate how many of those are inverted today. So every time in history, going back to the 70s, that we hit the 75% handle, we certainly had a recession follow, or sometimes even coincided with the recession. But it is important to point out, Jay, that we do not think this is 08 or 2000. I mean, we think this is quite different in a sense of we're not seeing the long end of the curve decline. We're seeing every yield in the Treasury curve rise today. And that is very similar to what we saw back in 1973-74 when we had a sort of an inflationary recession. And we think we're kind of headed towards something along those lines of what we saw back in 73-74.
And I believe this was this yield curve chart that you showed in your last Crescat Gets Active, number 71, is your own. You've come up with this on your own, I think, Tavi. Is that right?
That's right. I thought yield curves are always interesting ways to sort of predict and have a sense of the business cycle in general. And so Kevin and I were discussing, you know, is there a more comprehensive way? Because there's so many different forms of calculating spreads. You can look at the 3-month versus 10-year, which is showing a completely different signal than the 2-year versus a 10-year.
Yeah.
And so you can, you know, you can extrapolate those views according to just those spreads. And I think they all send different messages at some point. And so we decided to create something that, as I said, much more comprehensive that really encompasses all yield curve, all yield spreads. And you can do that across the globe, by the way. You can do that in Canada, Germany, and all those are starting to rise in that sense. I think, you know, personally, every time usually we reach the 30% or so, usually it tends to reach the 60 to 70% very quickly. And we have a lot of spreads that are very close to inverting. So we could see that in 2 weeks.
Yeah. At the very short end of the yield curve, I guess it's still a lot lower, but it could happen very quickly. Then if we get to that 75%, is there a lag time that you would expect
before you start? Yeah, that's the beauty of it. There's not really a lag. I mean, it's very close to the downturn in the economy, and usually linked to the decline in equity markets. In fact, we empirically look at this calculation to see what assets perform very well. And guess what? Gold is one of the things that performs very well. And we had, I think the only time that gold did not perform well was in 1989 during the SNL crisis, when gold actually declined during that time. But we did see a recession regardless. So, you know, I think that statistically, given the fact of where we are in terms of the pillars of inflation and the problems in terms of the monetary issues we have globally, I would be very surprised if gold doesn't perform as well as it did back in 73, 74, even 2000 after those inversions reach about 70, 75%.
Yeah. Well, you would think that if we start to, you know, if we head into a real deep recession of some kind, that might not be bullish for gold. A lot of people sort of are of that mind anyway. I'm not necessarily. But I guess then what it would be is the massive stimulus that would come after that, the devaluation of the dollar, essentially the massive money printing that would drive the gold price up.
Well, in that respect, I would comment that, you know, like Tavi was suggesting, that we think this period is going to be a lot like the stagflationary 1970s, especially that 73-74 bear market, where you actually had a period where the Fed was raising interest rates, where 10-year yields were going up, and inflation at the same time was going up, even with all of the Fed tightening, even with interest rates going up. And so, I mean, yes, we do think eventually, especially now with the record global debt to GDP, and in the U.S. as well, that the Fed is going to have to cry uncle and give up on its tightening plans. But for now, you know, they need to maintain their credibility. They need to raise interest rates. And even in that rising interest rate environment, we think inflation is going to prove to be a much bigger, a continuing problem. It's not the raising interest rates is not going to be enough to stop inflation, especially given that most of the inflation today is caused by structural supply shortages in the resource sector, that, these are long-term imbalances that are not going to be rectified by the Fed raising interest rates. Raising interest rates can squelch demand, but it cannot increase supplies of commodities.
Well, I remember the 70s, 73, 74 period very clearly. Yet I was a young man during those days, but the Fed was clearly behind the curve then, as it seems to be now. You have, negative real rates. I mean, isn't that the key? Negative real rates. And when Paul Volcker came along and hit the brakes, and all of a sudden my first mortgage was a 17.5% mortgage, that certainly sent gold downward, but we're not looking at any kind of positive yields, I don't think. Are we? I mean, is that even a possibility anytime? And what happens
I don't think so. Back in 1980, when Paul Volcker got short-term rates up close to 20%, and that's what it took to really finally squelch inflation. And even then, people didn't believe it was going to work. But that's when the price of gold topped out after an entire decade almost of raising interest rates, We're a long ways from that today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what about silver? And silver is a monetary metal, obviously. I look at it not as thoroughly as gold, as thoroughly a monetary metal as gold, but nonetheless, it is a monetary metal. And then what about the other commodities in an environment like this? Might we see oil prices really get slammed hard, or do you think they'll continue on, very strong? All the commodity, again, Kevin, I think you mentioned supply shortages, that supply chain issues that are really exacerbated by this war in Ukraine, big time. But about some of the other commodities in this environment if we head into this massive a recession that could be, in my view, could be quite deep?
I think it's across the board, across a number of different resource commodity segments of the economy that are going to be affected due to years of underinvestment in CapEx in the base metals and precious metals industries. It's been almost a decade of underinvestment, especially by the majors in exploration and building new mines. And on the energy side in oil and gas, there's this whole new carbon reduction, goals and the new energy economy that we're trying to transition to, it's really hard to transition to a new green economy when people need food, people need energy, they've got to heat their homes, and the renewable energies are just not up to scale yet in being able to satisfy that demand. The energy return on energy invested is still very, very poor among many of the renewable technologies that you need oil and gas to produce solar panels and infrastructure just for the renewable, whether it's wind turbines or solar panels. I mean, in order to make this transition, we still need oil and gas, and it's been under invested. And Tavi, do you have any comments on the commodities at large?
Well, look, I just think that there is a simplistic way of watching these industries, which is just looking at the CapEx cycle. And this might be the first time in history we're seeing oil prices, it's just so volatile, but call it around $100 a barrel, WTI prices. And companies are just not being able to increase their capital spending at all. And in fact, if you calculate just the guidance for CapEx for 2022, and you adjust that for where GDP is relative to other times in history, we might be at the lowest levels in 30 years. And so, if we had what we saw back in the 2008 times when oil prices declined along with the global financial crisis, where companies were actually spending record levels of CapEx in aggregate, this is not the case today. It's quite the opposite. So I think it will take some time for that to really infiltrate the system. So I think oil is headed much higher. Oil, net gas, any other commodity, natural resources in general look extremely cheap. That rotation should just continue, in our opinion.
Yeah, and especially Germany getting rid of its getting rid of its nuclear power. And you would think that uranium might have some potential. Do either of you have an opinion on uranium?
I think I'll just point it out quickly that I think for us, our niche has really been looking for commodities that really offer that supply imbalance first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And talking to Quentin and doing our own research certainly seems like we have enough uranium in the world. It's just more mm-hmm. of a political shift that may actually benefit the industry. We think the industry will benefit from what's happening. We've been time to time investors in some uranium companies, but it's not our sole focus. I mean, certainly our focus has been more in the metals with Quentin, and I think it's most of our expertise there. But you know, sure. Energy is very interesting. Agricultural commodities, we've been buying agricultural commodities for some time now. And so those are all ways of playing this natural resources bull market.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I have to ask you, both of you, about the recent developments last week with the Russians requiring or saying that unfriendly countries are going to have to pay for their natural gas in rubles. And there's, you know, some considerable commentary about it on the internet, and I just wondered if either of you had any thoughts about that development, because it seems to me that what Vladimir Putin is doing is pretty much what the United States did when we went off the gold standard 1971, shortly thereafter, when Kissinger was sent over to Saudi Arabia to make it mandatory for the world to pay for oil in dollars. Any thoughts on that development from either of you?
Yeah, Kevin, you want to say something?
Well, sure. So I know you had some thoughts about the ruble, Tavi, too, but I'll let you say that. But first, let me just say that, one thing we're excited about is the at least with, is really the U.S. the opportunity here in the U.S. for the natural gas industry and the LNG export industry to be able to help fill that gap in helping Europe meet its demand for natural gas. Because they did become so reliant on Russia and they have a problem now, but that's an opportunity. The U.S. is now going to be the largest LNG export country on the planet, and there's a number of terminals under development. I think the Biden administration is becoming more open. You just saw a deal announced between the EU and the U.S. on that front with respect to LNG. And I think it's going to open up more exploration, more opportunities for the E&P companies and the oil and gas exploration companies, as well as the midstream, the pipelines and the LNG export terminals. So we're invested in a number of those countries. But I think, Tavi, you said you had some ideas earlier you were talking about with the ruble and gold, et cetera.
Yeah, no, I just think that all ties back to our views on the treasury market. I think what we saw as far as the Ukraine and Russia problems, we've seen sort of a tectonic shift happen in the geopolitical landscape. And in our opinion, this really changes how the dynamic of demand for treasuries. One of the most liquid assets in the world now was basically put into sanctions and Russia wasn't able to use those reserves. So what does it mean for countries now when it comes to really financing the U.S. debt going forward? Well, you can break down the U.S. debt demand very easily. It's really the Federal Reserve has been buying most of it, U.S. banks and financial institutions domestically and foreign institutions in general, because households are not participating as they used to back in the 40s, for instance, when we had war bonds and so forth. So it really questions who is going to be picking up the slack here in buying those treasuries at a time when we're seeing record amounts of net issuances of treasuries of close to $844 billion issued in the last 3 months. So we're short treasuries. We think that's the next market development to unfold. And I think it's going to have a lot of unintended consequences from the technology sector. How do you justify something with cost of capital rising and even perhaps forcing the Federal Reserve to do some sort of yield curve control, which would be incredibly bullish for something like gold. So I think we're going to see that in the near future.
Mm-hmm. It certainly makes sense. To me, it's mind-boggling to think about these inflationary pressures because of supply shortages and the Fed, having this rising inflation problem and not being able to put on the brakes, not really being able I mean, it's got to fund itself. Where is the money going to come from? I think it's the printing press, and it's very frightening. But I'd like to, before we run out of time here, get into some of the performances of some of the funds and their performances, remarkable as they are, during the first quarter of this year, having just closed the first 3 months of 2022. The global market, the global hedge fund, the global market hedge fund,
macro,
I guess.
Yeah,
the macro hedge fund. Up 27.1% over the first 3 months. That compares with the benchmark of HFRX Global Hedge Fund Index. That was a negative 1.2%. So obviously you're doing something right there. That's for sure. Can you maybe, Kevin, just talk about how did you perform so well?
Well, we've been fortunate this year as part of this overriding great rotation theme. And out of long duration, overvalued growth stocks and into fixed income securities and into undervalued commodities and commodity oriented equities. We've gotten a number of our sub themes right, and both on the short side of the equity markets and the long side. We've also been short German bonds and treasury bonds, which have worked to our advantage through put options. We've had a short position in the Japanese yen. We had been actually short JGBs too as part of that debt to GDP resolution, where we think that inflation is the unwritten game plan for central banks in order to devalue the debt. At the same time, to maintain their credibility, they do have to raise the interest rates, and so we. You know, even in Germany and Japan, where interest rates were below zero, we saw an opportunity to get short, and it worked for us in the first quarter. But when the Bank of Japan said that they were going to have to exercise yield curve control, basically, mm-hmm. we pivoted quickly to being short the yen instead of being short JGBs. So the one theme in our global macro fund that really didn't work in the first quarter that we still think is poised to work is our short Chinese yuan trade and Hong Kong dollar potential depegging. The biggest credit imbalance in the world today, we think, is in China. They've created over $50 trillion of debt in their banking system and have a massive non-performing loan problem that we think is finally coming to the fore here with their real estate clampdown and the stock market crash that they've had. So while the Fed is raising rates, China is going to be forced to ease. So that's an exciting opportunity we still have ahead. But we think it's still early for a lot of our themes. But that's just a sampling of the things that have worked for us in the first quarter, a number of commodity related longs and a number of other short positions that we've had.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess much of what you just said would also apply then to the long short hedge fund, which was up 18.5% versus the benchmark of minus 0.1%. Anything to add with regard to the long short hedge fund that you didn't cover?
Well, the long short fund, that's really an equity long short fund for us.
Okay.
That's where global macro is, where you get all the fixed income and currency trades in addition to the equity long short trades, but the long short, that's just more focused on the long short equity themes, we talked about with both the software and the mega cap growth stocks that were short, and as well as the the commodity related equity longs.
Your precious metals hedge fund, which was up only 3.6% compared to the benchmark Philadelphia Gold and Silver Index, which just really focuses on a few of the big boys. I mean, you are invested in the junior exploration space for a reason. I mean, obviously, everybody knows when the bull market starts, everybody runs to Newmont or Barrick. What is your long-term view, then, of these exploration stocks that Quentin Henning's talking about? How do you see these things playing out? I mean, these big guys, you're creating wealth, really creating wealth. Newmont is a known quant. You know what Newmont is. You know what Barrick is. Maybe either of you could comment on some of the things that Quentin talks about every week.
Sure. I think we've seen sort of a safe haven rally since the beginning of the year with the war breaking out. And this is quite normal to see the money starting to institutional capital start flowing into most of the big names, and that's indeed what we saw. Now, I think if we agree that we're at the beginning of a bull market for most of the mining companies, in which mm-hmm. you can see it in many ways, the cyclicality of the fundamentals and the profitability of the companies improving is I think what it matters the most. And when we looked at the supply cliff issue happening across the major companies that are going to be needing to purchase other assets to replenish their production line, I think would be one of the biggest cases for owning exploration assets. And I should mention another one, which is really owning gold and silver in the ground at a time when you're seeing companies getting squeezed by wages and salaries and energy costs in general. I think that owning an exploration asset that is high quality is actually going to have a bigger leverage to the metal price that provide even further appreciation in price, obviously, in the following years if we get this bull market going. But, you know, just looking at the miners, the Philadelphia Index that you're referring to relative to gold mm-hmm. prices, you know, we're breaking out from a major downward trend. I mean, this is mm-hmm. this is just the beginning, in our opinion. So mm-hmm. there's a lot more to go. And when things start going, you know, it's a matter of time, in our opinion, for capital to start flowing into the riskier parts of the market, which is really the exploration assets. And I don't mean risky, but it really is historically undervalued and something that has been unloved. You know, not a lot of folks in companies have been putting much attention into what's happening in that part of the industry. You know, you see great intercepts coming out, not being rewarded by the markets. I mean, it's mm-hmm. just completely inefficient, and great mm-hmm. opportunity for a fund like ours to accumulate assets that are high quality and can perform very well.
Indeed, when you have these inefficiencies, there's opportunities, and that's for sure. And I have to believe, and I certainly must say, this yield curve control thing, Tavi, that you mentioned, if we start to see that as the Japanese are doing, and where else are people going to go? Where else are they going to go? I mean, I guess you can, as long as people still want to believe in the tooth fairy, I guess stocks can go up as long as there's enough liquidity to allow them to go up. But if they keep tightening, you have to think that, you know, some of these tech stocks are going to have their difficulties. I guess that's just about all the time we have. Any last thoughts from either of you?
Oh, I just say do go check out our website, crestcat.net. And we've got links to the YouTube videos on there, the Friday activist videos that we do with Quentin Henny. We've got our investor letters up there. I encourage you to go take a look at those if you want to learn more about Crestcat. And if anyone's interested in any further, Merrick Iwahasha, he's our client service representative. His information's on there, too, if you want to learn more about investing.
Excellent. Wonderful. And you can learn an awful lot about investing if you just go to the Crestcat Gets Active YouTube every week at 2 o'clock. I guess it's 2 o'clock New York time, about noon your time out
That's
there?
Right.
Is that when you try? And yeah, a lot of times I know you're busy trading and can't get to the mic right away, but it's interesting because there's always a lot of people at 2 o'clock start waiting to hear you come on. So you're very popular, and it's very, very, a very good service. I want to thank both of you for spending time with us today, and we'll look to keep up with you going forward. Well, that is all the time we have this week. Next week, my guest, Alistair MacLeod, is here to talk about his latest essay titled Edging Towards a Gold Standard. Also, Quentin Henning will be with us to talk about SK Mining, and Michael Oliver will join me once again to give his latest views on the markets. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Firefox Gold is exploring in Finland in the midst of an exciting new gold rush. Firefox successfully drilled high-grade and visible gold in 2021 and is now active at 4 prospective projects with plans to drill continuously through the first half of 2022. The company's strong international leadership team, combined with its Finland-based exploration specialists, are driving the company to discovery, and the stage is set for Firefox to identify multiple new gold deposits. Firefox Gold trades on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol FFOX and on the OTCQB at FFOXF. Go to firefoxgold.com to subscribe for updates.